Here we are again. 30 years ago, I stood right here and started preaching as you searched for a new pastor. And it's hard to believe. Those of you who were here back then are probably a lot like me, a great deal older, a tad bit slower, but still really excited to see what God has in store for Valley Covenant Church. What impressed me back then about this church was, right from the get-go, everybody just pitched in and did what needed to be done. Preaching, teaching, visiting, praying, caring for one another. It was unusual because I have filled the pulpit in other churches too, a number of other denominations. And the maturity and the giftedness of this congregation is truly remarkable. I once heard that in the covenant denomination, the average tenure of a pastor is about 7 years, which means you guys have been really blessed to have had such continuity with Steve and Beth. But I mention this because at Trinity Covenant Church in Salem, they in the last 40 years, we've had 6 pastors, which is pretty close to that 7-year average. And I was present for all 6 of those pastoral transitions, and I learned through that a crucial lesson. Pastors come and pastors go, but the one essential constant in the life of any congregation always remains the same. And that constant is Christ. And I know that sounds ridiculously obvious and even simplistic, but I think it's a reality that we can easily take for granted. And in doing so, we relegate Jesus to kind of a backdrop, kind of ecclesiastical wallpaper. But when Christ is the vital center of a congregation's life, then nothing, absolutely nothing, not even the loss of a beloved pastor, can shake its focus, its joy, its confidence. And so for the month of July, I want to do just that. I just want to focus on what I like to call the beauty of the Lord. And I want to look at Christ from 5 specific perspectives. The beauty of his humanity, his wisdom, his mission, his deity, and his lordship. Taken as a whole, I want to just help all of us once more to remember just who it is that we're all about. Now, I realize that's asking a lot from just a handful of sermons, but you know, I've learned over the years that all preaching is an immense act of faith. So please pray for me, would you, over the next month? Now, it might seem obvious that we should begin with the humanity of Jesus, but this is actually, when you think about it, it's a very neglected topic. Because we worship a living, resurrected Christ, because we use such exalted language when we talk about him, about this Jesus who is here, now, literally, we can unconsciously adopt the mistaken idea that, yes, the eternal Son did take on human flesh at a point in time, but that's over and done with. We can read about the historical Jesus in the Gospels, but that's essentially in the past. And when we start thinking about it like this, we have unknowingly blundered into one of the earliest distortions of the Christian faith. Way back in the 2nd century, there were people who, because of their exalted worship of Jesus, claimed that his humanity was actually an illusion, and that even his physical body was an illusion. These people were called docetists, from the Greek word dokein, to seem. Jesus only seemed human. And this view was roundly rejected by the vast majority of Christians and condemned at the Council of Nicaea in 325. Because what the New Testament bears witness to and what these early Christians so vigorously defended was that Jesus of Nazareth was fully, authentically, emphatically human. And yet, divine all at the same time. He was not God masquerading as a man, and he wasn't just a mere man who somehow became supercharged with God. He was the unique, never-to-be-repeated phenomenon of God becoming authentically human without ceasing to be God. And what's more, in his resurrection and ascension, Christ took this divine human union with him, so ensuring for all eternity that we too can live forever in union with the living God. Now, I know this is very high theology, and maybe it doesn't sound particularly meaningful right now. Hopefully by the end of the sermon it will. But Luke, the gospel writer, as Brian so beautifully mentioned to those kids, you know, even though Luke's gospel goes to the greatest extent in covering all of the miraculous details around the birth of Jesus, he also goes to the greatest effort to remind us that Jesus had to grow up just like the rest of us. He writes, "And the child grew and became strong. He was filled with wisdom, and the grace of God was upon him." And then later he writes, "And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man." In short, Jesus had to develop mentally, physically, spiritually, just like the rest of us. The process involved all the normal kinds of learning and maturation, including infancy, adolescence, and adulthood. He had to learn how to coexist within a family, how to read, how to participate in a community, how to learn a trade from his father. All of this involved asking questions, wrestling with problems, learning to tackle new situations. Now, admittedly, he was exceptionally bright and perceptive. And yet, not only did Jesus have to develop like the rest of us, he had to experience all the same limitations that we face. Throughout the Gospels, we witness him becoming weary, hungry. Three of the Gospels tell an event where he was so exhausted that he fell asleep at the bottom of a small boat in the midst of a huge storm. What's more, his interactions with other people produced the same wide array of emotions that we experience every day: surprise, joy, sadness, anger, humor, longing, and disappointment. The New Testament does not give us a static, ghostly Jesus who somehow hovers above our existence. Instead, we read of Jesus weeping at the death of a close friend, enjoying a wedding feast, becoming angry at people who refused to admit they were wrong. Jesus knew loneliness. He knew misunderstanding, even from his own family. He had a wide range of acquaintances, people from all walks of life. And Jesus wasn't even afraid to lean on his closest friends in his hour of greatest need, as we read in the Garden of Gethsemane. But you know, in order to really understand the humanity of Christ, we first need to ask ourselves, what is it that makes us most human? What does it mean in practical terms to be human at all? Philosophers, scientists, poets, theologians have wrestled for centuries with what are the key characteristics that separate us from mere animal life. And the list usually includes things like our rationality, our creativity, our moral awareness, our spirituality, and so forth. We are thinking, creating, praying, choosing, self-reflected people. We have basic instincts that we share with the animal world, but we're also capable of critiquing them and controlling them. But does this really capture the essence of what it means to be human? Another way to approach the question is to ask, what is the opposite of human? Or to use the antonym, what does it mean to be inhuman? The dictionaries use words like cruel, savage, heartless, which all describe how a particular inhuman person relates to other persons. These adjectives assume that being human or inhuman has something to do with how we treat other persons. Or take that word person that I've been using, which is actually a synonym for a human being. To be a person means that I possess certain qualities, but specifically, I am one person among other persons, which is why we often use the word impersonal to describe behavior that's detached, remote, cold, or less than fully human. What all of this language that I've been using is trying to convey is that a core, possibly the core dimension of being human, is that we are beings who are designed to live in relation to other beings. We possess the gift of language, perception, reflection, moral choice, specifically for the purpose of living in a meaningful way with others. Indeed, such relationships are essential to our very existence. There's a mass of medical evidence out there that demonstrates that people who become disconnected from other people do not do well, both physically and mentally. Without the participation of other humans in our lives, we begin to atrophy mentally and emotionally. What all this boils down to is that we need to be known deeply by others, and we need to know others deeply in response. And what happens in this whole process of disclosure and discovery, this exchange of understanding, hopefully we develop what we call love. That is, we develop a deep and practical concern for the other person, as well as receiving that same concern back. And we see this impulse most powerfully in the life of Christ. He wasn't some solitary hermit or a mystic who lived primarily alone. He came from a large family. He had numerous friends. He traveled with 12 very close companions. He enjoyed the company of people, even in festive ways. In fact, his enemies called Jesus a drunkard and a profligate simply because he enjoyed participating in gatherings where alcohol was consumed and people were sometimes of questionable morality. But nowhere was this deep human need to both know and be known, love and be loved, as fully satisfied for Jesus as in his communion with God. This for him was the taproot that fueled his every waking moment. As he said to his closest disciples, "This is my food, to do the will of him who sent me." Jesus understood far better than most of us his utter dependence on God for every breath he took, every thought he had, every effort he made. You could say Jesus was a God-obsessed man. This explains why prayer was so hugely important for him. There was this profound knowing and being known that existed between Jesus and God that just shaped everything about his life. And consequently, when he was asked, "What is the greatest commandment?" it was a no-brainer. "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, with all your mind and all your strength. This is the first and greatest commandment." But having God at the center of his life didn't protect Jesus from experiencing temptation, conflict, misunderstanding, hostility, and all of the moral conundrums that the rest of us face every day. I think that famous verse in Hebrew puts it best when it says, "Jesus was tempted in every way just like us." Now, we instantly want to spiritualize that verse and assume that, well, but his temptations were probably on some exalted level, right? But the author of Hebrews was absolutely correct. His temptations were just as mundane and ordinary as ours. For example, take the famous temptation in the wilderness. Just take that first temptation for just a second and think about it. Let me read to you from Matthew 4. "Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, 'If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread.' Now, the setting sounds rather dramatic, I admit, but actually this temptation captures probably the most ordinary, mundane temptation of human existence. Jesus was led by God into a desolate Judean wilderness where food was not accessible. I have personally walked in that very wilderness, and there's not a more God-forsaken place on the planet. And what's more, Jesus was clearly directed by God to stay there for a very long time. We actually have records of people who have fasted for 40 days. And you know what? By the end of 40 days, you are literally starving to death. Certain bodily functions are beginning to shut down. And so when it says Jesus was hungry, we need to appreciate what an understatement that is. He was starving to death. And so it's no surprise that precisely at this moment, the most common sense, logical, and natural suggestion should present itself to him. Jesus, if you are God's son, if he truly loves you, then your suffering like this can't possibly be from God, can it? Food is a God-given necessity. It's a normal and essential ingredient to life. Consequently, there's nothing morally wrong with eating to sustain yourself. So in the name of all that makes sense, Jesus, feed yourself. Can you identify with that? I can. And in that powerful and yet subtle temptation, we come face to face with the core temptation of all human existence. Does God know what he is doing? Especially when he takes something away from us that's perfectly normal, healthy, and innocent. Can God be trusted? Who really knows what's best for us, we ourselves or God? Is our physical existence the supreme good in life, or is life more than just this brief span of years? And because Jesus was truly human, this temptation was intensely real, which also means he possessed the capacity to make a free choice. And choose he did. Jesus answered, "It is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God." In short, Jesus chose to trust God in every aspect of his life, even in the hard times. Now, at this point, someone might complain to me, "Well, Mike, you know, the gospel accounts paint a picture of Jesus where he never fails to do the right thing, and thus he isn't truly just like us." And indeed, if there's one thing that characterizes our humanity as a whole, it's our staggering capacity to commit all sorts of evil, large and small, every day. And people are right that Christ displays an astonishing level of moral consistency. Yes, he shares our basic humanity, but he also demonstrates a capacity to always do the right thing at the right time. In fact, at one point in John's gospel, he actually challenges his enemies to find any fault in him. Which is an amazing thing for anybody to do. But does that make Jesus less than human? This question is crucially important because it begs the bigger question of whether the essence of being human at all requires that we exhibit a propensity to do evil. Or is our own humanity actually a broken vestige of what we were intended to be? There have always been people who justified their hurtful actions by claiming, "Well, hey, I'm only human." Such an attitude assumes that to be authentically human is to do hurtful things. And yet, if I happened to be the victim of that person's hurtful actions, my response would be, "Actually, your behavior is inhuman." And by doing so, when we respond like that, we are indirectly affirming the fact that words like good and evil are actually grounded in something real. Certain actions are intrinsically wrong, and others are right. And while virtually none of us are perfect, that very admission implies that this is a flaw and not a virtue. In other words, it's true that none of us are perfect, but at the same time, we know that we should be. In fact, our very humanity depends on it. The minute that we allow our hurtful behavior to become the norm, we don't become more human, we become less. And then, when we run into somebody like Jesus, who demonstrates an unblemished version of our humanity, we are shaken. We think, who is this guy? Is he for real? And this was precisely the reaction of many people around him. But it's also the very thing that kept other people following him. And here's the best part. In spite of his extraordinary moral consistency, Jesus also demonstrated tremendous grace, patience, compassion, and hopefulness toward his fellow human beings. The outcasts, the morally confused, those who were crippled by their own awareness of just how broken they were, these are the people that Jesus sought out to heal and to help. The only people he reacted negatively toward were those who refused to admit just how broken they actually were. So, what is my point in all of this today? At least two things that I want you to take away. First, Jesus is not some kind of cosmic symbol or paradigm. He's not some religious idea that we've cooked up just to inspire us. Nor is he an avatar in the sense of a deity masquerading as a human being. Jesus was a fully historical person. He was truly one of us. He knows the whole range of human experience. He knows our sorrows, our joys, our frustrations, and our fears. But the second thing I want you to take away is that his humanity is not crippled like ours. What makes Jesus beautiful for me is that he is a human in a way that I long to be human. He displays a humanity that is fully consistent and fully free from all the arrogance, greed, selfishness, fear, self-hate, all the ills that we wrestle with daily. He displays a beauty I long to both know and to share in. Yes, he was human, and yet he was so much more. And what that more is, we're going to explore in the weeks ahead. But you know, there in the world we live in today, the modern world, the scientific, sophisticated, rationalistic world, it's not the exalted Jesus that they struggle with or kind of push aside. In the world we live in today, people do not take Jesus serious because they know he was human and that he was a historical person. And the perfect example of it was our gospel reading today. Here's Jesus, already famous throughout the whole nation of Israel. He comes home to his hometown. Now, these are the people who had known Jesus since he was a little boy. He was no big deal. These people knew his family, who were certainly not perfect people, right? In fact, they assumed that Jesus was in every way just as broken as they were. And so they start thinking, well, who's this guy coming here to teach us? I can just hear them clucking. Who does he think he is? And the tragic result? Jesus did not do many miracles there because of their unbelief. So for this month, I want us to see the humanity of Jesus and then see through it to what more lies there. That's my prayer for us all. Come, Lord Jesus, come and help us all to see your beauty once again. Amen.